Think about it. Yeah, staff can vote on this one. Yeah. Committee of the Whole will come back to order. How many we got, Larry? Let's go. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 24.
Senate File 24, Supplemental At-Risk Funding for Early Childhood Education, an act relating to school finance, sponsored by the Education Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Senators Coe, Dockstader, Landon, Pappas, and Rothfuss. Senator Coe, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, moving the Committee of the Whole Rights Report do so do pass recommendation on Senate File 24 to defer to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is an act relating to school finance, extending supplemental at-risk financial assistance to early education programs, and it provides for an effective date. Members of the body, this is a fairly simple bill. This bill allows options. This bill allows options for school districts to use categorical grant funds for summer school and extended day programs for pre-kindergarten programs targeted to assist at-risk children.
Senator Pappas, pardon me one second. Senator Kinski, would you put your coat on? Senator Pappas, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So while the catch title says supplemental funding, please understand there is no additional funds appropriated by this piece of legislation. It simply extends the list of acceptable uses for funds that are already provided to the districts. The program simply allows early childhood education to be added to the programs of summer school and extended day intervention and remediation programs. So it's a very, very simple bill. I'll take you through it real quickly. Page 1, line 15, page 2, line 3, 6, 7, 14, and 21, page 3, line 5, page 3, line 23, and page 4, line 8 and 20, and page 5, line 4, all inserts early education along with remediation and intervention programs. Simple, just adding the flexibility for the districts to use their funds for early childhood education. Again, it's an option. Districts can use it if they wish. Now, there is a reporting requirement already in this bill, and so the early education efforts will then be reported as well to the department. Barring any questions, I move for the body's favorable approval.
Any discussion on the file? Any discussion? Any discussion on the file? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 24. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 24 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 92.
Senate File 92, State Construction Project, an act relating to administration of government, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 12, Rules, which returned a committee recommendation of do pass. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Kraft, Nicholas, Perkins, and Rothfuss. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
What would you guys like to do? You want to lay it aside?
Yeah, let's lay it back till the...
Okay. We'll set that one aside. We're going to take up Senate File 90.
Senate File 90, lifetime game and fish licenses, Purple Heart recipients, an act relating to game and fish licenses, sponsored by Senator Cooper, who has referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, which returned a committee recommendation of due pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Emmerich?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with recommendation of due pass on Senate File 90. Lifetime Game and Fish Licenses, Purple Heart recipients, and to explain this good little bill, I yield to Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill is about is that under the current law, the state grants free lifetime bird, small game, and fishing license to any military veteran that is 100% disabled. But there is no provision in the law for veterans that have been wounded in combat and are the recipient of the Purple Heart Medal that are not 100% disabled. There are a lot of these veterans that put themselves in harm's way for us and our country, and they could be walking around with various wounds to their legs and arms and also shrapnel wounds and so forth, but yet they're not 100% disabled, so they are not eligible for these free licenses. So what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, this gives us the opportunities that so we could do more for these wounded warriors, and this bill does allow us to honor them. The Purple Heart medals Purple Heart medals are only awarded to those that have been wounded in combat while putting their life on the line for our country. This bill simply gives us a way to honor those men and women. The license is only valid as long as the recipient remains a resident of the state. There are about 641 Purple Heart recipients in the state going all the way back to World War II. Because some of these 641 veterans are 100% disabled, they already are covered under the current law. It is estimated that only about 15% of the remainder would take advantage of this license, which represents less than 100 veterans. Mr. Chairman, if all 100 of these veterans, Purple Heart recipients, I should say, applied for this license, the estimated annual cost is about $4,700. However, there is a game and fish license revenue recoupment program fund that is available for these funds. There's about $980,000 in that fund, which is more than sufficient funds to cover any of these licenses, so there would not be any further costs other than that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I ask for your favorable vote.
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor. Where did the fund come from? I never understood. Was that general fund money that put aside to reimburse game and fish? Is that where it came from?
Senator Cooper.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's absolutely correct. It is a fund that sits in the auditor's office, and I think there's another $1.7 million going to be going into that account this time. They never use it all, but they keep enough in there for these various free licenses.
Further discussion on the Senate file. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, there's no account that's set aside for this. About 10 years ago, because of the fact that every session there is some needy group that gets a free or reduced hunting or fishing license, about 10 years ago, we put a law in place that because the game and fish was actually suffering, they had to pay for all these licenses that we were giving away. So we passed a law that said we will reimburse them for all the free and reduced licenses that we gave as a body, as a legislature. This comes directly from the directly from the general fund. Game and Fish estimates how much it's going to cost in these, and it's about $900,000 per year. That's why there's a fund there. It's not because there's some magic fund out there waiting for instance, Purple Heart recipients to get free or reduced licenses. That raises the question in my mind of why this bill wasn't re-referred to appropriations, because of the fact it is going to cost money. It's not going to cost a lot, but it will cost money. These are a very deserving group of people, but there are plenty of deserving groups of people who get free and reduced licenses. So my first question is, why wasn't this re-referred to appropriations? And the second is the fact that this is going to cost the general fund more money. And frankly, these free and reduced licenses has never been reviewed as to the significance of an overall global look taken at all the groups that get these. Just a little quick little piece of trivia. I was just reading the other day that in World War II, when the United States was looking at invading Japan at the end of World War II, they ordered and had made 500,000 Purple Hearts, because that's how many casualties they expected from the invasion. So the dropping of the A-bombs on Japan actually stopped that. Those same Purple Hearts are the ones still being awarded today to our soldiers. Were not required from the aborted invasion of Japan at World War II.
Thank you, Senator. Who's going to handle it from the appropriations? I can see Wassenberger. Here you go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is a very deserving program, there is no doubt. But then down the road, when money gets tight, you have a situation where our veterans' tax exemption came before the committee this year. And so, you know, I just think we need to have a little caution on some of these things. In good times, this is a great program. I'm not real sure we should keep this going. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Ross.
Well, my co-member of Senate Appropriations raises a valid point, something that we probably need to get a better handle on. This particular bill says that there's no fiscal impact. At least there, and apparently there is. I do not doubt that there is. But the rules are the rules. We had to do that with regard to Senate File 91, and I think you have to abide by the rules. If in fact there is fiscal impact in this thing, it has to be re-referred. Otherwise, it's out of order.
So we can handle that at any time. But Senator Emmerich,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe it. This was presented in our Ag Committee, and Game and Fish testified that there was no problem. There is no fiscal impact. They have the funds. And then we have other discussions. I really think this is a suggestion, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps this should be laid back until that particular question is truly identified, because there's two different conflicting opinions, and I think they need to be resolved.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cooper, do you want to address this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Matter of fact, as it was mentioned, when Game and Fish testified before the committee, they said there was no extra cost, that there was sufficient funds that they could draw on already within the account that was described earlier, and there wouldn't be, and there would be no administrative cost, because the program is already in existence for the 100% people, and they would just merely use that same program. So we may have to lay it back to look at it further, but that was the testimony we received in the committee.
Senator Scott, help us out.
Mr. Chairman, just looking at the rules, referral rule 4-8, referral of bills requiring an appropriation, bill containing an appropriation or which requires an appropriation or change in funds may be assigned to a standing committee other than appropriations, but if so, be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee upon being reported back in the committee first assigned. And then it says the Appropriations Committee. Mr. Chairman, we pass bills all the time without going through appropriations that have fiscal impacts, or that an agency alleges has a fiscal impact. And whether it gets alleged or not may depend on how the agency feels about the bill. But the rule is specific. The bill has to contain an appropriation or require an appropriation or change in funds. Mr. Chairman, that's not a fiscal impact. This one, yeah, there's an existing fund. It's there. It's adequate. This bill doesn't require an appropriation, doesn't require a change in those funds. I can't see any warrant under our rules to require that be referred to committee number two.
Thank you, Senator Scott. More on the point, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am confused, really confused, about what cost there would be. The only thing they're doing is issuing a license to a Purple Heart recipient, and I'm assuming they have some of those licenses printed and said we can sure print them and turn them out. It isn't that they're taking licenses away from a paying customer. They're issuing a non-revenue license.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify that, the cost is the associated replaced cost, recognizing that some of those individuals otherwise would be purchasing fishing licenses. It's difficult to calculate then what that offset cost is, but there would be some number of those individuals that would buy a fishing license. When they're given a free fishing license, there's an added expense, or you offset that cost, and so the revenue is decreased by that amount. And then theoretically also every fishing person has some nominal expense to the state to just continue the operations that require and regulate the operation of fishing, which is going to be distributed amongst them. So there certainly is some added expense to the state, albeit a potentially small one.
Thank you. I'm not hearing a motion for the committee to rise and then we go back and do a re-referral. So I'm not hearing that. So absent that, let's continue discussion on the bill. If someone wants to make the motion, they can, but we can do the bill one way or the other, and if there's second reading amendments necessary, we could handle it that way. Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been, speaking in favor of this bill, and we have talked about whether there's a fiscal impact or not, and I guess I would think that, yeah, there's going to be some kind of impact. My good friend from Laramie mentioned some of these individuals might buy a fishing license. We don't know that. But, it just seems kind of ironic that we're talking about some costs which might be pretty minimal, in my opinion. And what kind of cost have these individuals that we're talking about, what cost have they paid? So with that in mind, I urge you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Senator Burns. Let me get you.
Every one of these licenses is kept track of by Game and Fish, and then they go to the state auditor, and get that money back. They get recouped over $900,000 per year. We refund that money to the state auditor from the general fund. That is an expense. And with that, I'll move that this bill be re-referred to appropriations.
Senator Burns, this committee can't refer it. We're committee of the whole. The way that we'd have to do that is to rise and get out of committee of the whole and return to the Senate, and the Senate presiding officer could refer it. And so I'm open, but I'm not hearing it. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, could we just, I beg leave to ride and sit again for 5 minutes?
You bet. You've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Hey, Dale?
Yeah, I agree, and that ultimately
I think what's happened, quite frankly, this is what's happening when you don't have any money. Every bill is getting scrutinized, and that's fine. It should be. I don't recall. We had a couple bills that were due because there was fiscal impact. There's no appropriation. So we send it out with no recommendation. We're supposed to be.
So, I mean, the
cost. We weren't about to add
appropriation. And that's a good problem. It came so late because the total number is already part of the law. So it could be, to your point. How's a print a life?
No, because I would give them $12 for service. Like, now you can give it to me.
They start coming faster. That may be it.
Roll call, and they will get $120,000. This year,
No.
Well, he's been turning out an appropriation of the day for $5,000. Hey, if I had some hair, I'd pull it out.
You're just, you know.
Come back here and stay.
How are you?
Are you the only one with some sense in this body here?
How are you? Good to see you.
Well, not the sale, but it's just coming through.
Bruce.
We win. They
lose. You ready to go back?
Oh, that's cool.
This is where we are.
Oh. Hey, Tony, I've been there for that. You're there for the first time.
The Committee of the Whole will please come back to order for the Lutz Senate. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I meant the Senate. The Senate will please come back to order. Thank you. I apologize for my absence. We've been working on budget amendments for tomorrow to get the final balancers out, but I think this, we're all lined up. As I understand it, during the Committee of the Whole, you were debating Senate File 90 as to whether or not an appropriation was required. I'll hear from the movements. I'll hear from the other party and make a ruling, and then if you don't like it, you can appeal it. So the sponsor of the bill is, was it Senator Cooper? Who is the sponsor of the bill? Sponsor of the bill, your position with respect to an appropriation, whether it needs to be re-referred. Let me get your, okay.
Of course, my position is I don't believe it needs to be referred, and can I give an explanation?
Yes.
Why? Because the account that this, any reimbursement to the Game and Fish would come out of is set up in the auditor's office, and it's called the Game and Fish License Revenue Recoupment Fund. And they simply just apply to these funds for any recoupment money for these free licenses. And the way they testified in the committee meeting was that there are sufficient funds in there to cover this, and they would not need an additional appropriation to cover this fund. It's $4,700 out of $980,000 that's currently in that fund. So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, I would say my position is we don't need to do that. It should just flow as it normally does.
Thank you. As I understand, the request for the point of order was from Senator Burns. I'll hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, that recoupment fund, Game and Fish, every time that the legislature puts out a free or reduced license, Game and Fish notes it. They make a note of how many free fishing and hunting licenses they make, and the legislature has to appropriate that money to that fund out of the general fund. So although it's not a direct appropriation, and although this money may still be within that, the fact is this next year and ongoing years, we will have to appropriate to cover this. So I'm moving that this be re-referred to appropriations.
The Chair, Senator Scott, we'll hear from you.
President, Rule 4-8, referral of bills requiring an appropriation. Bill containing an appropriation or which requires an appropriation or change in funds may be assigned to a standing committee other than appropriation, but if so, should be referred to the Appropriations Committee. Mr. Chairman, this bill does not require an appropriation. There's an existing appropriation there. It doesn't require a change of funds. The existing appropriation is adequate. Most of the bills we pass, Mr. President, have some impact on an agency. Usually they're things that can be well accommodated within their existing appropriations. But I think here it's quite clear that there is the appropriation. It's already adequate. The agency so testified. And I think it would be a mistake to re-refer this bill because I think it sets a precedent that allows us to re-refer virtually any bill that somebody doesn't like to the Appropriations Committee, and I would urge you to rule that it's not required to be re-referred.
Thank you. The Chair determines that it does require an appropriation. It is not sufficient to say that there's an existing account that's there. that might accommodate for it. It's the responsibility of the sponsor of the bill as well as the committees to identify that when bills require appropriation and have a fiscal impact, that they be referred. And this does require an impact, and simply because there happens to be an account there with sufficient money to cover it does not change it, because the account was not appropriated for this bill. This requires a re-referral. So Senate file, without objection, Senate file 90 will be re-referred to appropriation. Now, a re-referral to Appropriations Committee can be considered any time between now. So the Senate file 90 is laid back till tomorrow. There is no requirement for advance notification by a re-referral to Appropriations Committee. I assume that they will exercise the courtesy to hear the bill before it comes back up tomorrow. Senator Bebout.
In that vein, as we're doing this, we got to be fair to everybody, so I will ensure that that bill does get to general file tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Assuming that I haven't been here. You've done like three bills since I've been gone, or? All right. Mr. Chair, are there any messages that we need to read in while we're here? Oh, Senator Bebout.
Yeah, Mr. President, the only bills we dispensed with had the name of the president on them.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. You can't blame me for slowing it down for the last couple hours. All right. There's no messages. We're at that order of business of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole to discuss bills on general file.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Oh, I'm going to say here. 92?
Committee of the Whole will come back to order. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 92. I believe that has been previously read in. We'll yield to Senator Nicholas. What is your pleasure, Senator Nicholas? We already read it in, so you just have to move it. It's Senate File 92.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise report to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 92, State Construction Project. Folks, what does this bill do? This bill merges the School Facility Commission, or the State School Facility Staff, and the Director with the construction portion of ANI Construction Management. And we are still working on amendments that there'll be an amendment tomorrow, but it's the intent of the bill, and to the extent that we require an amendment, we'll make sure the intent is followed, that the construction management part of large construction projects for out of existing ANI, that division be merged with the school capital construction division. We'll have one director over the top. There will be two divisions. The two divisions will largely operate exactly the way they do today, so that one division will be operating over school facilities and doing exactly what they do today, and it may be the director, or more likely the deputy would be reporting to the school facilities commission, the staff, and all that will run exactly the way it is today. Now, on the school side, it will include all the things that exist under the current law, and that would be major maintenance, routine maintenance that comes through them. Actually, I don't think routine maintenance would come through. It would be major maintenance, large projects. Exactly the way it happens today happens tomorrow. On the state side, the construction management team that are doing large projects and large major maintenance, and it probably will leave those would go into this division. Routine maintenance, leases, all of that stuff stays with ANI. What's the reason for this? Folks, I submit to you, if you begin to look at the various projects, we need to have a cabinet-level person that's responsible directly to the governor, that is appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate, responsible for all of these projects, everything. We need to have more collaboration between the experts that exist in school facilities and state construction. On the state side, you see that we may have a large project, nothing, large project, nothing, or we may have two large projects. On the school side, you see lots of projects going on, and frankly, I believe that we will find that there are synergies by allowing the staff, the engineering, construction managers to work with each other to extract the experiences of it. And by creating a cabinet-level person, I believe that the position of director will be more attractive to highly qualified people that have architectural degrees, engineering degrees, construction management experiences. And by having that person in a direct, as a cabinet-level person directly responsible to the governor, that we will have more control, more insight. On the state side, that division will still continue to support and provide direction under rules from the State Capitol Buildings Commission and, where appropriate, the State Land Investment Board. So we end up emerging, we keep the autonomies of the two, but merge them together with their expertise. We see that school capital construction we may have a lot of it, it may constrain. It may open up, be a lot of it in the future. Same is true on the other side. So we develop our construction expertise within it. Folks, when we did, your management council began looking at the issue of how do construction manager at-risk contracts get issued throughout the state, we find there's one set of rules for schools. There's another rules over here. There's no similarity in some of them. They're issued under different rules. Some contractors are permitted to go build all they want and begin issuing change orders right and left. Other agencies are constraining the issues. If you're a contractor responding to a bid, these large bids, the rules are different here, they're different there. But more and more, what we see, frankly, is that we have lots and lots of dollars going out, and we need a higher level of scrutiny on both sides. You know, I know that the school districts may be somewhat reluctant, but I submit to you that part of that reluctance is because they've kind of grown accustomed to the notion that they're the dog, the facilities commission is the tail. If you want a new high school, you go pick your site. The best site you would pick is 10 miles out of town, right where you're going to do most of your construction. You go out and pay a handsome check for the prize, and then you turn around and said, now build the infrastructure. And so then we come and appropriate the infrastructure for 10 miles of road. It's great for the town because they get to grow. It's great for contractors. It's great for everybody but the taxpayer. And it seems to me there comes a time where there has to be an overall master to employment. Who's your master? And even with the school facilities director, sometimes I wonder who's their master. Is it the school districts? Is it the commission? Is it the governor? Is it the legislature? Whose dollars are we watching? By having a cabinet level person that comes before you for advice and consent, I believe that we will begin to say the master is a state employee director responsible for all the costs, and that would be on both sides. When we begin to see these construction defects come in and you throw up your hands and you begin to see the solutions, I submit to you that it is time that we have a persons of higher skill sets, higher pay, and more responsive and more direct responsibility to the governor, which, by the way, makes more responsibility to the governor because it's closer to him. Right now, the school facility or the state construction manager reports to ANI, the director of ANI, who reports to the chief of staff, who reports to the governor, three steps away. What does that three steps mean? It means that if you want to go out and hire an architect to take that job, he says, I'm a fourth level person in a government structure. It's not really interesting to me. If we merge it, now you're the responsibility of a direct agency with combined resources of two groups, and it's a very attractive job. So I submit to you that this is the right time to do it. It's the right thing to do. There's a lot of flexibility in here for the governor to determine how we're going to create this marriage and the split apart from ANI. We've been through this with the ETS, so we know that it'll take a little while to work. We need to make sure it's transitions well, but I would urge your support for the bill. Stand for questions.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted to commend the president for drafting this bill for a couple of years now. My deskmate and I have visited quietly here with the notion that we ought to be able somehow to do this thing a little bit better. And frankly, that the president's right. It's really on both sides. But I just wanted to, throw out a couple of cautions. We finally, over the past couple of years, have gotten school facilities up and running pretty darn smoothly. And it's really going well, and I really think that they've done some good work. I don't hear quite as good of things on the other side. And frankly, have experienced through the work that I used to do in my college profession, you know, the fact that it's been pretty bureaucratic and not so great. I just hope that we don't get it all lumped together for not so great. I hope that the lump together would create better. The other caution that I have in my head is just I really hope that this isn't a cost driver. If we elevate that position, the office itself to a cabinet-level position, my hope is that maybe we can realize some savings and not grow a department a whole lot bigger. But I do commend the bill. I think it's the right time to do this. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, and this is a question for the sponsor, since I was looking at our list of appointments here, confirmations, and it says School Facilities Commission. Would that still exist, and would we still have confirmation? And I don't even know about the director. I don't know if that's a Senate confirmation or not.
Thank you. Further questions? Back to you, Senator Nicholas.
Folks, the commission will still exist, and so you'll have the right side on my flow chart being the School Facilities Commission, and on the left side, the equivalency would be the State Building Commission and the SLIB Board. They would do their respective rules and regulations, and this organization would serve both entities with common staff and using similarities. Folks, I mean, I present this with some reservation. I mean, I in the visiting that I've described to you where I've gone to other capitals to look at these facilities, you're told to go meet with their state architect and you go into and they are generally parts of their ANI administrative ANI divisions. And it's with some reluctance I pull it out, but there are significant differences. When you go to a place like Kansas or Minnesota, their ANI is off in one building, and then their construction manager is off in another building, and the construction manager that is it's a very well experienced architect doing extraordinary. You talk to them; they're extraordinary people. They're comparable to the MOCA folks the consultants that we have used for out of Utah. Phenomenal people, but they're also staffing 30, 40, 50 engineers. They're much larger departments. We're a small state, and so we're going to have to look at solutions that work for us. But we're also one of the only states in the United States that the state is responsible for school capital construction. So you're not going to find any other states that do it like us. But since the state is doing the capital construction, and our A&I is, I mean, it's traditionally been staffed with, we've gone for years where there's no construction. So, but we need to have everybody at a higher level of operation on cost controls, on issuing projects, making sure the projects are delivered. And while I hear that, and I understand, I agree that the relationships between the school facilities director and the schools is really great now, and it's been much improved. The other side of it is that we've been spending a lot of money, and with money, a lot of relationships become really great. And without money, they get strained. It's sort of the last. And so I think that these are all considerations, and I think you weigh them and balance it. But on balance, it seems to me that we ought to collaborate, bring all of our construction together, try to improve our entire construction management, take advantage of dollars spent on both sides to keep the expertise high on both sides. Thank you.
Further discussion? Further discussion? Not seeing any further discussion, the question is on Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 92. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Senate File 92 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 100. Senator Meyer, would you make the motion on this bill when we get around to it? Go ahead, Reader.
Senate File 100, Special Districts Emergency Medical Services, an act relating to special districts, sponsored by Senator Dockstader, was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a do-pass motion on Senate File 100, and I would defer to the sponsor, the good senator from Star Valley.
Senator Dockstader, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring you Senate File 100. Members of the Senate, it authorizes those with oversight of health care, such as your governing bodies, gives them direction related to emergency services. This designates the provision of emergency medical services by hospital districts and rural health care districts. Under 35.2703, for the corporate trustees, we add the emergency medical services designation, line 7, page 2. This includes the health care centers and the hospitals. Under 35.2703, we address the physicians and health care providers and again designate emergency medical services for those providing health care. We just bring the importance forth of the emergency medical services. It's kind of a theme I'm working on here this session and ask for your favorable approval.
Discussion on the file. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm going to need a little more explanation as to what this does. Does this now add additional authority for taxing for emergency settled services? Are they contained within the hospital? Are they freestanding emergency medical services? That's a big issue right now. I just need some better idea before I vote on this.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Dockstader, we'll go back to you.
Chairman, as I understand it then, we're just doing it. That provision had never been included with hospital districts and rural health care districts. If they wanted to provide a provision, they wanted to give specific authority to their emergency medical services. Now we have it specifically named. Prior to that, it had not been.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussions? Further discussion? Seeing no more discussion, the question is on Senator Meyer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 100. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 100 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 101. The reading clerk will please read the file.
Senate File 101, Public Health Laboratory Fees, an act relating to public health, sponsored by Senator Burns. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which reported back a recommendation of do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rise and report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 101. And there are no standing committee amendments, and I yield to the good senator from Sheridan.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 101, public health laboratory fees, codifies what we've been doing in the budget bill for the last 10 or 12 years, in that it states that the public health lab may charge reasonable fees for laboratory testing services to state agencies, local law enforcement entities, other individuals or organizations. The fees are established by rule. The amount must be sufficient to recoup the department's cost of providing the testing services. They have to make personnel available to testify in criminal trials as to the results, and that the fees collected go into a special revenue account. Those funds cannot be expended until the legislature appropriates the funds. Mr. Chairman, this is word for word from what has been in the budget bill for over a decade now.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion on the file. Any discussion? Seeing none. The question is on Senator Ross's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 101. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 101 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 62.
Senate File 62, Homemade Beverages, an act relating to alcoholic beverages, sponsored by Senator Kinski. Was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinski, Landon, and Peterson. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of It was amended, right? And you read that. You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with favorable recommendation on Senate File 62, there is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask for that to be read at this time.
Senate File 62, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 5.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for an explanation on the amendment and the bill. I would turn it over to the good senator from Sheridan.
Senator Kinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we move the amendment?
We have not moved it. It's been read in.
I would move the amendment, Standing Committee Amendment 1, to the bill.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is fairly straightforward. If you've ever been to a brew fest anywhere in the state, you'll usually see craft brewers there giving beer away. You pay a gate fee, and you see craft brewers. They give you a 2-ounce or a 3-ounce taste of their wares, and you pick a winner. Some of these you may also see home brewers doing the same thing. Well, recently the homebrewers received a cease and desist order from the State Department of Revenue that they were to no longer participate in these brew fests. And it was for two reasons. First, they said, state law says you can brew your own beer only for personal use. And second, they consider the gate fee to be a sale. So what this bill does then, it turns out Wyoming law simply says personal use with respect to homebrewers. But federal law, passed right after Prohibition, actually says you can homebrew 100 gallons per year and 200 gallons if there are two or more adults residing in a household. It further allows for the removal of this beer from the household to organized affairs, exhibitions, or competitions such as homemakers contests. I like that, homemakers contest. You see Betty Crocker, I think, somewhere in there brewing beer. Homemakers contests, tastings, or judging. So the first thing we'd like to do is take the federal definition of personal use and move it into Wyoming's definition of personal use. The second portion of it, the consideration by the Department of a gate fee as a sale, the second thing the bill does is say that as long as the home brewers are not receiving any cash or anything of value, they might receive a prize, then it's not considered a sale. And typically what happens in these things, the entire gate goes to a charity. So the KC Brewfest, that all goes to the KC Chamber of Commerce. The Buffalo Oktoberfest, that all goes to the Buffalo Chamber of Commerce. So with that, I would like to walk you through the bill and the amendments, because the amendments, which were fashioned in conjunction with the State Liquor Division, as well as the organization representing the liquor dealers, simplifies the bill and actually got to the bill to the point where they both endorsed it. So page one, what we talk here about is homemade beverage tastings, and from there over to page two, what we're doing is adding that because these judgings have to be under the auspices of an existing licensee, the way these events happen is the Chamber of Commerce takes one of their leading retailers, the leading retailer lends their retail liquor license, the City Council approves an off-premises use for one day, and it says a licensee cannot serve outside of their licensed premises, but this amendment would add on line 5, right after beverages, nothing in this subsection shall be deemed to authorize any homemade beer, wine, or fermented fruit juice to be packaged or otherwise provided for consumption outside of the premises where the judging, tasting, exhibition, contest, competition, or related event is occurring. Now, that's never been a concern at Brewfest, but the department wanted to make absolutely sure. Subparagraph B from 12 to 22 simply says that the licensee sponsoring the event will not keep any of those beverages. They are only to use commercial beverages. Then on page 3, running through it quickly, they define financial consideration to say that it does not include a tax deduction or credit for making donations. It doesn't include a admission charge. It doesn't include a prize. Over to page 4, it doesn't include getting beer as a prize. It doesn't include getting any ingredients that you can use in making beer as a prize. F, it doesn't include wages and salaries paid by any educational organization. Then we define homemade. That's an existing statute. Sub Romanet 3, non-commercial, and here's our next amendment page 4, line 16, after we strike dependent or and we insert sold, offered, for sale, or otherwise. So it reads non-commercial means not sold, offered, for sale, or otherwise conditioned upon the provision. Now down to lines 20 and 21, we strike the reference to 12-2-1201B. We strike 12-4-502A reference and the C reference because we worked through it with the department and we struck those entire sections. Now we're moving over to page 5. This title means 12-2-201, beginning wholesale license, strike out everything down to line 23. It was something that LSO staff suggested and the department didn't feel we needed it, so it simplified things. Flipping over to page 6, strike everything from line 1 down to line 8. Just get rid of it. 12-3102 on pages 6 to 7 and the following sections authorize the department to seize any non-commercially or brewed, you know, illegal stilled goods and it adds this subsection that says it doesn't apply to homemade beverages going to or from or in one of these events. That's what those two sections do. Down to line 18 on line 7, strike 12-4-502, the entirety from there, strike all of page 8, and strike the top two lines of page 9. Then 12-8-102, again, now we're going to the definition of homebrew. It says manufacture, rectifying, or sale. Down at the bottom, it says the prohibition of not manufacturing doesn't apply to homemade fermented juices and so forth, as long as it doesn't exceed 100 gallons per person or 200 if there's more than one in the household. And then down at 16, you have to have a license. It says that doesn't apply to homemade beverages provided in an event. So in its essence, we're grafting the federal definition that says you can take home brews to a show, and all the necessary statutory adjustments to accommodate that. And we're saying that an entry fee at a brew fest does not constitute a sale. And with that, I would ask your favorable consideration of the amendment and Senate File 62.
On the amendment, Senator Bebout. Anybody else? On the amendment, discussion on the amendment. Senator Von Flacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out all this struck language. Is there somewhere else in the statutes that talks about, like what we struck was retail sale only from a Wyoming wholesale malt beverage licensee? Is there somewhere else that says that? Because I don't think you can buy a malt beverage in this state that didn't come from, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like we're striking out a lot of language that exists today as far as legal jargon and regulations that they must follow. Is it somewhere else in the statutes? That's why I'm missing what we're doing here.
Senator Von Flatern, is that in Section 1 or Section 2?
Let me go to, it's page, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, it's page 5. We're deleting 8 through 23, and I think the next 8 lines on page 6.
Senator Kinski, if you can.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator, we are not excising from law the requirement for a wholesale license for sale or of malt beverages. That language is reproduced simply for purposes of showing on lines 22 and 23 where LSO had suggested an amendment. The department said they didn't need it, so we struck, you know, once you get rid of that amendment, those few words on lines 22 and 23, you don't need you don't need the rest of that section, but we are not deleting 12-201 from law. We're just deleting it from this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So it's not necessary to be in the bill, but it is in law. It's a Section 2, so it was amended section. We don't have that section necessary now because the amendment isn't warranted, but it still stays in law. We okay? Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, the question is on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Back on the bill. Anything else on the bill? Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two questions. One is a general question about a beer fest, who can go and if there are any limitations on the entry relative to age, those kinds of things. And the second question, I'm just curious why you took out the tax deduction on page 3, lines 8 through 10. Was there some kind of federal precedent, case law or something? I mean, I don't know why if I want a home brew and I want to give it to a nonprofit, I shouldn't try to declare it as a tax deduction because they certainly would utilize it. Maybe it's considered a sale. Maybe that's why.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious about the on page 1, line 2, mead that is in there. I think we're kind of talking about homemade beer here, and I looked up mead on a certain electronic area. It says it's the ancestor of all fermented drinks. And Claude Levi Strauss, I will say, says there's a Norse mythology that it was crafted from the blood of the wise being Vassar, which turns the drinker into a poet and a scholar. So I wonder about that mead in this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Kinski, can you help us out?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. With regard to the question who can go to these events, it takes two to put an event on. First, it takes a retail licensee, and then it takes the host. So what happens is the Chamber of Commerce has one of its retail liquor licensees. They come together and they say, in Whitney Park in downtown Sheridan, we are going to have from 2 to 9 a brew fest. So the city council has to allow open container, and they also have to allow that event to take place. Because what you actually do is, as you know, retailers are allowed to do off-premises catering. It literally is a catering permit under the retail license. And the department wants it that way because ultimately then the retail licensee is ultimately accountable for what happens at that event. So they have every incentive to make sure the home brewers, as well as the craft brewers, have tips training, that there's people not under the legal age there, and that all the necessary rules and regulations are enforced. With respect to the tax deduction, if I understand what this section actually says is, if you make a tax deduction of the beer to a nonprofit, that does not count as financial consideration, and it's something the department wanted in there, and I've never heard of a tax deduction being donated to somebody as constituting a sale, but the department wanted it in there. I'm not quite sure I can answer the question. I can certainly get an answer for that by second reading. And then with respect to mead, I think the fact that mead converts a drinker into a poet and a scholar is not unique to mead. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on Senate File 62? Further discussion? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 62. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 62 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 50.
Senate File 50, Sexual Assault, Position of Authority, an Act Relating to Crimes and Offenses, sponsored by Senator Boner. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, who returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatern. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 50. We also have a standing committee amendment. We could have that read in.
Senate File 50, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 11.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment and to present the bill and the amendment at its appropriate time, Senator Boner.
Senator Boner, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as I stated in the initial vote on this piece of legislation, the premise behind this legislation is to ensure that we protect our students all the way up until they graduate from our K through 12 school system. We're protecting them from predatory behavior on the part of faculty or staff, and as it stands right now, their protection only extends up to the point where they turn 18. So we find ourselves in a situation where there could be an open sexual relationship between a student and a member of the faculty or staff, and that is perfectly legal under our statute. So we seek to, like I said, extend that protection up until the point where they graduate. This reinforces the societal trust that we have in our school districts, that when we send our kids to school, they're not going to be subject to this predatory behavior. It also maintains and enhances an adequate educational environment for our kids, especially given the investment that we do place in our school districts. I think this is especially important. So getting into the bill and the amendment, since the amendment deals exclusively with the definition sections, which is the first part of the bill, you'll see right now, if you go to page 2, line 5, right now the way that our definition sections of a position of authority, what it states is simply teacher. Case law has said that that includes, in fact, a teacher and a coach, but that's all that it really, all the light it sheds on the subject. So when these situations do arise, and just speaking anecdotally with the district attorney locally in Commerce County, there is some confusion as to what that means. Is a teacher in the United States? Is it a teacher within the same school district? Does the teacher actually have to be teaching that student in question? So that's a big part of the reason why we went and cleaned up this definition section. So you'll see we drew the sideboards at the school district level. So any teacher and any student within the same district, that is what qualifies as a position of authority. Keep in mind that we're not just talking about a teacher overtly threatening a student, say, with a negative academic outcome. But just, we're talking about the grooming behavior that often takes place in these cases. And if you had a chance to listen to some testimony when the judiciary heard about this, you'll see that it's not necessarily as simple as the teacher actually having that student in class. All they need is that access. to that student. They can start that grooming process sometimes for years up to the point where it becomes legal for them to act upon that process. So that's what we're acknowledging here, is that it's that access to the student that's just as important. So as you see, we made a few exceptions. We want to make sure we exempted a student employee. That's important. We didn't want somebody being captured under this definition who's just working summer maintenance as a student. We also want to make sure, like I said, the victim has to be enrolled in the same school district. Also, and so this is where the amendment comes in. You'll see the first part of the amendment is page 2, line 11. It ensures that we're talking only about K through 12. So we're not going to be capturing our community colleges or our university in this definition. So we're just talking about K through 12 here. That's what that amendment accomplishes as a suggestion of staff at a later time. So we're in good shape there. Also, more significantly, on line 19 of the same page, we're basically striking that subsection 2, that paragraph 2, and inserting the following language, basically stating that the faculty member in question has to have contact or interaction with the victim by virtue of that person's employment. So that really gets to the crux of the matter, that they're using their position to gain access to these children and exploiting those children in doing so. So there's some discussion in the committee, and I'd like to address that now about, okay, and especially in some of our smaller towns, it could be rather ambiguous. So you can know somebody outside of the school environment but still use that position to take advantage of that. So the question is, where do we draw the line if the potential actor knows the student outside of the school environment? And after consulting with staff, you need clear and convincing evidence. Prosecution, we need clear and convincing evidence that contact did take place in the school environment. So it's not a preponderance of evidence. It's a higher evidence, as we expect in criminal code, to prove that, in fact, they did use their school district employment to gain access and to strengthen that grooming relationship with the student in question. So that's ultimately, it's going to depend on the facts of the case. Ultimately, it's going to depend on the state proving that inappropriate relationship did indeed exist within the school district environment. So moving on to page 3, basically we carved out a section within our sexual assault statutes, our third-degree sexual assault, for this sort of behavior. And basically what we did here is we wanted to basically take the principles that govern our sexual abuse of a minor statutes, because that is what we're dealing with, and find a place for it in our sexual abuse statutes. So that's why you'll see that it's third-degree sexual abuse, and by way of comparison, a similar situation when the student is 17 or younger carries a maximum sentence of about 20 years, and this is a maximum sentence of 15 years. So we're acknowledging that, in fact, there are adults, but it's still certainly a violation of that societal trust. So it would be a 15-year maximum sentence. We maintain the 4-year exemption. So if they're within 4 years of each other, certainly a violation of professional standards, and there would be an expectation that the school districts would act accordingly, but not necessarily a violation of our criminal statutes. And getting into subparagraph C, and this is very important, inflicts sexual intrusion on the victim or subjects the victim to sexual contact. This is important because, once again, sexual abuse of a minor statutes, they do distinguish between the two, and there's a significant difference in sentencing requirements between sexual intrusion and just sexual contact. So that's why you'll see that can be either or. Then in paragraph B, just below us, are in line 18. It specifies that if the actor is convicted and only subject the victim to sexual contact, then that sentence is not going to be more than 5 years. And that is as consistent with our sexual abuse of a minor statutes, the corresponding statute on our sexual abuse of a minor statutes would be fourth degree sexual abuse of a minor, and that would carry the similar sentence of up to 5 years. And then if you turn to the last page, it's simply providing an exception for that differentiation between sexual intrusion and sexual contact. So that's the bill. I'll entertain questions on the amendment at this time. If anybody has any questions.
Question on the amendment.
Question on the amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, the motion is on the Senate Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 50. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment's carried. Back on the bill. Who would like to discuss the bill? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quickly, I had a question for the proponent of this good Senate file. Was there any discussion about the proximity of school districts in Wyoming and all of the state culminating type events, all the times that we gather together? And it says that as long as this teacher or employee of a school district isn't perpetrating this behavior on somebody in that district, does that open it? It still leaves it open for neighboring districts, for example, or at those state culminating events. Was there any conversation about that, about blanketing the state, saying anybody in our K through 12 system, we don't want this behavior, even if it's in the district next door?
Any other questions? Any other questions? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too have a question for the sponsor, and I've been thinking about this legislation and trying to think of some of the potential unintended consequences that may play out. And one that I thought of was what happens if the student simply drops out of school prior to having any type of sexual relation? So there's some intent, there's some attraction there, something along those lines. So the option the student takes is, well, I'm 18 years old, I clearly can do whatever I want, I can join the service, I can do all of these other things. So it's time for me to drop out of school. Does that then obviate any potential charges under this? And then what happens if the student rejoins school? So I'm a little curious about how this plays out in some real-world scenarios. Thank you.
Senator Boehner, should we go back to you so that it doesn't pile up too bad?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that's an excellent idea.
Okay.
As far as the culminating events, there's no specific discussion as far as, you know, maybe a statewide event, how that would play out. There was a significant discussion regarding where exactly we draw that line at the school district, whether it be a school district level, statewide level, specifically at the school. And the feeling was, and my feeling is, that it's harder to make that justification that somebody in a completely separate district is really going to be in a position of authority, especially if it is a statewide event where you might have contact, you know, maybe once, almost by definition, maybe once. So we certainly did have that discussion. We realized that we have to not cast it too wide of a net, and certainly didn't want to. We want to strike a balance. So that was part of striking that balance, and so that's the reason why we put those sideboards at the school district level. As far as the idea of either the student dropping out of the school or perhaps the teacher even quitting, whatever the case may be, or really certainly even the student graduating, the there being no real proof that a relationship existed up until the point where the student graduated, as abhorrent as the behavior might be, our ability, and I can certainly stand corrected by the attorneys in the room, if there's no proof of that a relationship existed while the student was still in school, or even now up until the point where the student turns 18, my understanding is that the state just simply doesn't have that compelling interest to pursue a case. There's no, and especially when we're talking about adults, there is that the rights that we have to consider of the adults in question. So whether it be the student dropping out or the teacher quitting or simply the student graduating, at that point, once there's no longer that professional relationship, and if there's no proof that actually anything untoward did happen, while there's still that professional relationship, I'm not sure that we necessarily have the grounds to actually prosecute that sort of behavior. So.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Any further discussion? Senator Rothfuss.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just one more question, I think, on this. And it goes to the comment from the sponsor about the abhorrent behavior aspect. And I can certainly envision circumstances unquestionably where it would be abhorrent behavior and predatory and a lot of the things that we're really trying to address when we look at legislation like this. But at the same time, I can envision scenarios where it's honestly perfectly reasonable, maybe improper, and not something that you would want to happen, but I'm imagining now a 23-year-old who becomes genuinely attracted to an 18-year-old. And it's a reasonable circumstance that happens all the time, but now you have the two people where one of them is teaching at a school in a position that may or may not have a direct authority, but we've got some language there which provides a relatively broad interpretation there. And they have a genuine attraction, form a relationship, and all of a sudden that individual then, the teacher, is labeled abhorrent and is a sexual predator and is a felon. So the state is then deciding that the state has to obligate the funds, the resources, to protect the rest of the people from that individual for 15 years. And is there a way that we can craft this more narrowly so that we're addressing the predatory behavior that really is more consistent with the sexual offender that we're trying to target, and the more natural impropriety might be a workplace punishment. I mean, I can see firing a teacher over that without a problem, but labeling them a sex offender, felon, and ruining the rest of their life for what might have been bad professional judgment in some circumstances, not all, but some circumstances, troubles me. So I'm curious what the sponsor's thoughts on that is.
Senator Wassenberger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having been an educator for 33 years now, this is something that should never happen, ever, in our profession. And it's a black mark on our profession. And testimony at the Judiciary Committee was heartfelt. And to hear that testimony, you know how this can wreck people's lives. So I don't have a problem saying to a teacher, principal, coach, if you do this, even if that student is of the age of consent, it is wrong and it is a felony. I have no problem with that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. I do have one question for the sponsors of the bill. And that is ultimately, when you look back and you come back, well, you look at 62303, which is second-degree sexual assault. And generally what you have is that ultimately this is where it says that this is a person if you're in a position, it's in A6, says that actor is in a position of authority over the victim and uses this position of authority to cause the victim to submit. So that's already in statute, and that's second-degree sexual assault. And so if you take the first part of this bill and you move it, you've now expanded the person in authority to include that. And there's no age restriction. There's nothing on that. That's just overall you do that. So I'm wondering why are we shoehorning this into third-degree sexual assault, when if you expand the definition as this is a person of authority, and more important, and the differentiation is that it requires the use of that authority to cause the person to submit. That's certainly a different circumstance than what you've got in this bill, where that doesn't require, as I read the bill, it doesn't require any use of that authority to cause the person to submit. So you're taking, if there's no coercion through the police of authority, you're taking what would otherwise be consensual and legal behavior, and you're saying that's illegal. Now, this isn't the only time we've done that. We've made that the same effect that we've made it. Basically, we've moved those requirements and said if you're a correctional officer and you have that issue with an inmate, that's immediately sexual assault. So we're somewhere, we've kind of done this before, but I don't understand why we're shoehorning this into a different area, and then removing the element that requires the use of that position of authority, the use of being a teacher, the position of authority to cause that submission, somehow cause that submission. I'm struggling with where we're going on this. I don't understand that.
Okay. Senator Scott, hold on. There you go, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, following up on that in some of the professions, and it was present, for instance, in the Occupational Therapy Act that we just dealt with earlier in this session, if there was any sexual relationship between the professional and the patient, you could get subject to discipline by the board, could lose your OT license. The equivalent here would be, the Professional Teacher Standards Board. But it didn't have to rise. The criminal statute was left alone, and that would govern the existing criminal statute that was just cited. So that's an alternate regime for dealing with these things.
Okay. I think back to you, Senator Boner.
Okay, certainly appreciate the questions. There are differences between our sexual assault statutes and our sexual abuse of a minor statutes. As I stated, we were trying to extract the same principles from our sexual abuse of a minor statutes and find a place for them in our sexual assault statutes. So, looking as far as the question is, why is it third degree sexual assault instead of second degree sexual assault? It came down to the sentencing requirements. Second degree sexual abuse of a minor is a maximum of 20 years. Secondary sexual assault is also a maximum of 20 years, but also there's a minimum two-year sentence. So it didn't make sense to us to, as the kid progresses in age, to 18 years old, to have a more stringent sentencing requirement. So that's why it's in a third-degree sexual assault. And we're acknowledging to the more general point as to why the secondary sexual assault is not sufficient to be covered under these statutes. It is represented to me, and certainly, I can stand corrected, that caused the victim to submit language. It certainly implies a more coercive, overtly coercive element to the relationship. So it's different from being a prison guard in charge of a prisoner. So that's why the fact is, this sort of behavior has happened within the state, and there are no charges that were brought. So that's the emphasis of the bill, is that we aren't sufficiently covered with that secondary sexual assault statute, and even if it would be covered, then it wouldn't make much sense. I mean, if you look at it in terms of the progression of the student going from a teenager up until 18 years old, it didn't make sense for us to have a more stringent sentencing requirement. So that was the reason for being in third-degree sexual assault.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Christensen, let me get you lit up here. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the sponsor. I'm not sure how this we didn't ask this question in the committee, but curious how that would affect someone who may reached the age of 18 and married a person that works in the same district while they're still, at some point in that school year or before the school year. How does that apply to a married person?
Senator Boner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could certainly verify with legal staff, but my attention is drawn to 62-307, which is evidence of marriage as a defense. And it says that in 302 and 303, which is so that would apply to first degree and second degree sexual assault. So perhaps not what we're talking about here, but it says that that's not a defense. So it would seem that by omission, like I said, I'd certainly need to confirm with staff. I can get back to you on second reading. But just a simple reading of the statute would seem that could be a defense. But that's something we can also look at in Section 307. So very good question. I'll get a more firm answer on that.
Good. Are we ready for the question? Seeing no more discussion. The question is on Senator Christensen's motion, right, that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 50. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 50 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 51.
Senate File 51, Post-Conviction Actual Innocence, an Act Relating to Criminal Procedure, sponsored by Senator Esquivel. It was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation of due pass amended. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Kinski. Noes, Senators Hicks and Von Flatern. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen, you've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 51, Post-Conviction Actual Innocence. There is a standing committee amendment. Could you have that read?
Can we read the I'm sorry? I'm sorry, Senator Ross. I didn't see you. I apologize.
No, that's fine. Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I got a feeling, boy.
Boy, I am sorry, but Mr. Chairman, this bill was not referred to Appropriations Committee. I'm not trying to be obstructive, and I'm not trying to create a problem here, but mm-hmm. but this one particularly has a problem. This one, this if you look at the fiscal note on this, this bill intends to appropriate money or compensation for those that were wrongfully convicted when they were innocent, up to $500,000. There is language in the bill on page 13 that says that, you know, if there's not any appropriation, then they don't get compensated. However, I was chairman of appropriations of judiciary in the day when we did DNA, DNA innocence. And we went to appropriations. Appropriations struck out the appropriation, but at least we went through the process. This one has not. And so I rise for a point of order.
Thank you. Senator Christensen, to the point of order.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the bill be re-referred to appropriations.
Okay, we cannot do that in Committee of the Whole. But we can go through it again if you guys would like to. There's been a motion. Senator Scott.
Chairman, this bill, I don't have any dog in this fight. Don't know anything about the subject matter particularly. But is this bill merely an authorization so that if there's an appropriation in the future that was proposed, we could then, without having to have a separate bill, go ahead and make that appropriation? Is that the intent, sort of the authorizing system that the feds often use? Or is this bill going to require things be done, whether or not there's an appropriation where there might be an immediate fiscal impact?
Somebody would like to address that. Senator Esquivel.
Mr. Chairman, as has been noted, this bill does not provide for an appropriation. Yes, it does call for, in the future, compensation should certain conditions be met. And some states have an insurance pool, things of that nature. But this is simply a means to provide a vehicle for some people to make amends to some people that the state has wronged. We've been talking about protection. A good friend from Campbell County, talking about the previous bill, said this should never happen.
Well, Senator Esquivel, let's just deal with whether it needs appropriation or not, and then
I don't think
you'll get your due. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, let's just lay that bill back.
Okay. We'll lay it back for a little bit. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 52, the State Shrub.
Senate File 52, State Shrub, an Act Relating to State Symbols, sponsored by Senator Driscoll. Was referred to Committee No. 5, Agriculture, which returned a committee recommendation of due pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Geis? Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 52, State Shrub, pass. And for a discussion of this wonderful little bill, I refer to the round mound of sound from Devil's Tower.
Senator Driscoll, I hope this bill doesn't require an appropriation.
Mr. Chairman, round mound, here we are. So I'd ask for your favorable consideration on Senate File 52, State Shrub. State Shrub is Wyoming's big sagebrush. I can't pronounce the name of it in the bill. We've got a little problem there. If we need that, I will refer to the good Senator Baggs to do the Latin interpretation, if any of you'd like to ask that. This one's for the kids. You all know that. We've done it. We're going to start with that. This is for the kids. So our class came up on this one, testified at 9 o'clock, did a phenomenal job. I wish we could have them up here and do it, because I'm not going to do as good a job as they did, but I'm going to do my best for you. I'll keep it short so we can have a pizza break here in a bit. As you know, it covers two-thirds of the state. Big sagebrush, perhaps the most important shrub on the western rangelands. Evergreen leaves and abundant seed production provide an excellent winter food source, numerous species, large mammals, including mule deer, black-tailed deer, white-tailed deer, elk, pronghorn, antelope, bighorn sheep, and jackrabbits. Nearly 100 bird species depend on sagebrush ecosystems for their habitat needs. Additionally, there are several animal species having an obligate relationship with big sagebrush, including sage grouse, sharp-tailed grouse, pygmy rabbits, sage thrashers, sage sparrows, and brewers. So as you can tell, this is a keystone for the entire state, represents our state phenomenally. The kids couldn't have picked anything better for a state shrub, and I would encourage your passage of this so we can move it on. Thank you very much. Stand for questions.
Discussion on Senate File 52, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, two questions. I tell you, I've done in the past some burning these things to improve sage grouse habitat. It is useful to periodically burn off one of these stands so that they then renew and you get younger plants. And I'll tell you the Senate, it's a lot of fun to wander through the prairie with a drip torch, dripping out fire and starting things on fire. And I would hope this bill wasn't going to interfere with that practice any. It's very useful. And then, you know, I see it does make the state shrub Artemisia tridentata. The question is, why don't we make it sagebrush generally include Artemisia cana and Artemisia negra in the species that are covered?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if there was any consideration given to Fallujah paradoxa, the Apache plume. Butterflies and bees are both attracted to said shrub. That's what I'm looking at, shrub. And it's apparently quite hardy and drought resistant. So I asked the sponsor if any thought had been given to that alternative shrub.
Thank you, Senator Rothfuss. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I am concerned about this. I don't know what kind of protection that the state shrub might convey to this in the future. Right now, I know a lot of people that burn this shrub and dig it up and plow it in to make other areas. And if this would cause that to be protected in some way, this is a real problem.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Should we go to Senator Hicks next?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer some of those questions presented by the good senator from Albany County and the one from Natrona County. There's over 19 different species of Artemisia tridentata in the state of Wyoming. There's numerous shrubs, but there's only one shrub known in the world with the subname of Wyomingensis. This is Artemisia tridentata Wyomingensis. Let's hear one for Wyomingensis. The cowboy shrub.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll rise and answer a few of the other questions. As far as the burning end of it, digging, spraying, anything else, the class went through it at length. We offer no protection for anything else of our state symbols. If you want to pick our beloved state flower, you can. You can spray it. You can dig it. The absolute same is true with sagebrush. They did go through all the shrubs. The class exhaustively did research to try to find the right one. They happened to find one that had Wyoming in its name. How fitting can you get to have a state shrub? You're not going to find another one with Wyoming in its name. It does do one other thing for the good senator from up in the great city of sagebrush. It raises recognition that our state does value sagebrush for what it is, for habitat, for one of our keystone species, which is sage grouse. And that's really important. When you go to the conservation community, the boys that really kind of like to hate our industry, it tells them we care about it, and we do care about it. And that's, I think this bill has significance that way. We have no problem with somebody taking it out, doing whatever, but this is a good bill. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 52. Further discussion. Seeing none, the question is on Senator Emmerich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 52. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 52 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 78.
Senate File 78, Office of Consumer Advocate, repeal date, an act relating to the Public Service Commission. Sponsored by Senator Bebout. Was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Cooper, Von Flatern. Noes, Senator Rothfuss. Excused, Senator Anderson. Senator Cooper, acting chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 78, Office of Consumer Advocate, repeal date, and I ask yield the floor to the good majority floor leader.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe there's a standing committee amendment. I ask that to be read at this time.
Senate File 78, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 12.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, you know, when realizing, of course, we had some revenue issues, huge revenue issues, and the responsibility of us as senators is to take a look at all aspects of government as to cost effectiveness. Does this program really work? Are we getting the bang for our buck, so to speak? And I, for one, think that the government has grown. There's a lot of programs that we certainly ought to look at. Some we may need to repeal. Some we don't need anymore. Some came in with good intention. Things have changed. Or maybe, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, we just need to have a hard look at them and re-look at their mission, and they need, so to speak, a kick to get back on track and do what they were supposed to do in the first place, and they sort of lost their way. One of the things I came across, Mr. Chairman, when I looked at it, was the Office of Consumer Advocate. And this sounds like a wonderful deal for the state of Wyoming, and I think initially it was. And, Mr. Chairman, as I started looking into it further, and I talked to people about the benefits of it, and quite frankly, rather than hearing how much they'd helped them or what the good they'd done, they were all disappointed. At least the ones I talked to were disappointed. They were disappointed because they didn't feel like they had the opportunity to be represented. They were disappointed if they were a commercial power buyer, that, in fact, all they did was more or less go in there and work with the PSC and split the sheet, if you will, on how they represented that particular individual. Then I went back and looked at my power bill just to get an idea of how effective they might have been, and I did it over like a 7 or 8 year period, and I tried to adjust it to inflation, and my power bill is way out of whack relative to inflation. So I'm thinking, well, what has this government group actually done for the consumer? And so that's why I brought this bill, Mr. Chairman. I thought about just repealing it and just terminating it altogether. That wouldn't have been fair. So I thought, well, the way to do it is give them day in court, so to speak. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, there was an effective date that it would be repealed, 2023, and I know that the good sponsor of this bill might be able to shine some light on why they picked 2023. Maybe it's because it was 10 years after the bill was introduced. I'm not sure.
That's the sponsor right here.
I know. I know who the sponsor is, Mr. President. But anyway, what I did in this bill is I removed that date of 2023 and I made it 2017. And the whole purpose of that, Mr. Chairman, was to refer to the Minerals Committee, take public testimony and see if they really are doing what they intended to do. And maybe there's a real miscommunication between the people that think they're representing them and the fact that they don't represent them. So that's the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chairman. It's about a $2 million budget, I believe, for the biennium. And I'll be glad to answer any questions. As far as the Standing Committee amendment, I didn't make that. It came from the committee. Maybe someone could speak to that as to the rationale for it.
What's your pleasure? Do you want to take up the amendment? Standing Committee amendment? Senator Cooper.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, after hearing the testimony in the that we had in the meeting, one of the members of the committee decided that maybe it would be better if we pushed it out 1 year so it would hit in like the budget year instead of during the general session, and just decided to give it a little bit more time and also to give it some time to review this particular agency and what they did. So the committee just felt that probably a little bit more time would be better, give more accurate information.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion is on the Standing Committee Amendment. Senator Bebout. Oh, it has not been moved. Thank you very much. Senator Cooper, would you move the Standing Committee Amendment?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 78, is it?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would speak against the Standing Committee Amendment. I mean, let's take a look at this thing, but we don't need to study for a year and a half. We don't want to kick the can down the road. Let's give them a fair shot. Let's have the committee hear what they're doing, whether we want to have it the repeal go into effect or not. That can all be done during this interim. I would ask that the body defeat the Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you. Further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Senator Coe.
Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, we had pretty aggressive testimony in committee, and I'm not sure that the majority floor leader could be there for it in opposition to the bill. So I brought the amendment with the idea of, you know, it was originally 2023, and the bill changes that to 2017, I think June of 2017, and I thought, you know, give them another year. So I'm the one that proposed the amendment. And I think given, you know, one more year, we had quite a bit of opposition in committee to this particular bill, speaking as, in, you know, advocates for the group. So I just brought the amendment with the idea of giving them one more year.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As everybody knows, this is my bill, and quite frankly, the reason we selected 2023 was the very fact that the bill was introduced and was passed in 2003. I'm going to urge you to vote aye on this on the amendment. Because I think that this office does do its job. There's only 6 individuals in this office, and the administrator and the deputy administrator work full time as analysts within the office. This office is not funded by the general fund. It's funded by fees, paid assessments from the regulated entities. And it averages about 5 cents a month. There is nobody to represent the consumer's interests when you have these rate hearings, except for the Office of Consumer Advocate, period. Now, there may be some question as to whether or not they're doing their job. I guess if you vote for the amendment, at least you'll get an opportunity to know. But the Office of Consumer Advocate does not set the utility rates, but their job is to advocate and has advocated against rate increases. But it's the Public Service Commission that ultimately determines, based on all of the evidence, what the rate should be. So if you get rid of the Office of Consumer Advocate, you get rid of potentially one half of the evidence, and all you hear from is the utility. And so I'd urge you to at least pass the Standing Committee Amendment, and then we can talk about the bill.
Discussion is on the Standing Committee Amendment. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the difficulty with standing committee amendment, as I understand it, is it pushes the discussion of the bill to remove the sunset then to a budget session where it's harder to get things done and there isn't the time for the consideration. I would prefer to defeat the amendment and then defeat the bill. The difficulty here, Mr. Chairman, and I suppose your Corporations Committee would be the one to hear this and could sort it out, but the difficulty here is if you don't get rid of the expense, if you get rid of the office, yeah, you still need to have somebody preparing the case on the other side so the commissioners can do a responsible job, and you simply taint the opposing case because they work for the people making the decision. And that was a problem all along before we did this. So I don't think you save any money, but I do think it would be better to defeat the standing committee amendment and then deal summarily with the bill.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the tall senator from Natrona that we need to probably defeat the amendment and not take it into a budget session. But I also, you know, I couldn't make my own committee hearing, so I wasn't given all the testimony. But I can, the people I did speak to all were from industry, so I kind of wondered why the pro-consumer advocate's office, why they were from industry, and aren't they supposed to kind of oppose them or at least give the other side of the story for the consumer's part? And I didn't hear that part.
Thank you, Senator. Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Senator Ruffus?
I'll wait until it's on the bill. It's more appropriate for the bill.
Thank you. On the Standing Committee Amendment, Senator Escobo.
Yeah, I would ask that you vote in favor of the amendment. Because I think, the consumer advocate is the only officer we have that works for the consumer. And I'll just leave it at that and hope you vote for the amendment.
Okay, are you ready for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question is on Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 78. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has failed.
Division.
Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. It's 12 to 16. The amendment has failed. Back on the file. Discussion on Senate File 78. Senator Ruffus, you want it up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we did have good testimony and extensive testimony in the committee, and without exception, all of the interested parties that were present did oppose this legislation for a variety of different reasons, and as to the majority floor leader, unfortunately, had to be in another committee and didn't have the benefit of hearing all of that detailed testimony, and unfortunately, so did the chairman. It would have been good to have everyone there because it was very compelling testimony. We had individuals from localities represented, one of whom I can hear his pickup truck starting in the parking lot. He provided testimony on a specific instance for his community where the Office of Consumer Affairs was intervening on their behalf, and they absolutely won. They won hands down. They took it to the PSC, and it turned out to be an abusive rate increase, and in fact, there was no rate increase that ensued. It ended up saving the people of that community a substantial amount of money over the past few years, so that was a raving review of their performance. We did hear from industry, multiple advocates from industry, that basically said it was beneficial for them to have somebody to engage with. That was the key. There was not the need to organically grow a lawsuit and then have it go to court. There was a process in place, Mr. Chairman, and that was why there was advocacy from industry, because even if they lost the process, there was a process that facilitated a much more expeditious outcome than what would happen just by having lawsuits come into place. So there was benefits there. And then there were just consumer interest groups that were present, all of which supported the OCA and the elimination or termination of this piece of legislation, recognizing that it has served in the past. Multiple examples of historical interventions by the OCA were provided to the committee. And, Mr. Chairman, really the only reason the long litany of the great success stories for the OCA ended was because the rest of us had to leave the committee meeting, and we had to hurry it up and cut it off. So, Mr. Chairman, there was no advocate in terms of public testimony for this piece of legislation. There was an awful lot of advocacy for the OCA, so I'd just like to make sure the body is aware of the testimony that was provided. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Further discussion. Senator Bebelt.
Chairman, I wish I would have been there and would have heard that. And there's a great annual report that you all should pick up and read. And the thing that strikes me about it is when you look at the cases that they list in their report, you know, all of them, they recommend increases, rate increases, in every one that was in here. And that was one of the issues I had. If they're going to really represent us, why do you always raise the rates? And I understand the PSC, and it's built in because they're a regulated utility. They're guaranteed a rate of return on their investment. I understand all that. But I read through the thing. I just did not see the representation was there. I wish I would have heard the former president of the Senate talk about what happened over in Goshen County, but I wasn't there. So I would ask that you vote for this. We're not eliminating it. We're going to take a look at it, and if it's a good agency, and we, you know, obviously this is more discussion that's been had about this agency since the former president introduced the bill. This is all positive stuff. Let them make their case, and if it's a good case, it'll still be around. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, it's so hard. Pick any agency or anything in government and try to talk about eliminating that program. They all have a constituency. This is no different. It's just a very difficult decision. I would ask that you would support the bill.
Question. Further discussion on Senate File 78? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Von Fleischern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 78. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 78 has failed Committee of the Whole. Having failed a roll call vote, we'll do a standing vote. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Senate File 78 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is 75. The vote was 15 to 13. The chair votes with the no, so it was 15 to 14. It's passed Committee of the Whole.
Well, we don't know. There was one off before. And he's back. Point of order. Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Point of order. Senator Rothfuss.
Despite my desires, he was off the floor when the vote was concluded, and therefore your decision should stand in my view of the rules.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. That's the point. I would yield to your discretion, but the vote's been taken, and it's been recorded.
Yeah, I don't see how we can allow someone that was off the floor to come back in and vote. So this will have another day. See you tomorrow. Senate File 78 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again until 7 p.m.
Wow. You've heard the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Sort of.
Opposed? Senator Ross.
Before we recess, we're going to have some dinner here, and then I want the Appropriations Committee to meet in our later. Just off of our JAC meeting room for consideration of re-referral.
I think you have to make an announcement on the floor, don't you?
We're not
on the floor right now. We'd have.
But we were going to leave, and
I'll be up there.
Okay. But let's. So the motion is the committee of the whole is recessed, but we're going to come back into the Senate.
Yeah, we'll do that right now. No, you have to be committee of the whole.
Oh.
Yeah. So hold on. Action's taken. Yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Hold the fuck.
Yeah, so who's making that request? Are you making the request for the re-refer?
This is Escobar's bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let's go back and address Senate File 51. Do we have a motion?
Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, I'd ask to re-refer Senate File 51 to Appropriations.
Without further objection, Senate File 51 is re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations. The title is Post-Conviction Actual Innocence. Do we have any other Senate Committee messages or messages from the House? If not, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Senator Ross.
We'll go down to the JAC, right off JAC main room, to hear the re-referral of Senate File 90, Lifetime Game and Fish Licenses, Purple Heart Recipients, and Senate File 51, Post-Conviction Actual Innocence.
Any further announcements? If not, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, no. The Senate shall stand in recess until, you say 7? 7? 7 p.m.? Thank you.